This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Here on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, Susan Eckelman Burkle is an associate professor of history and current director of UTC's Africana Studies program. This semester, she is teaching a course titled History of White Rage. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about this course.
So I'm teaching a course on the history of white rage this semester. The idea for the course, it's a new course, even though I've taught courses on American racism in the past, this is a new course that really came to my mind during the summer of 2020 when we've witnessed the revival of Black Lives Matter movement. And we heard, and I'm sure Ray, you did too, the phrase racial reckoning. We heard a lot of, especially white Americans, coming to grips with the fact that racism was well and alive. And that there was the sense sort of that because people are coming to terms with it, that there is progress in sight. Of course, people were eyeing at the election in the fall. And in my own research, what I've discovered is that when there is racial progress, there is also a backlash. And certainly we can see that happening. We can see that materialized in the election of Donald Trump. This response to a Black presidency, the ultimate Black advancement. So I wondered how long this racial reckoning might last. And that's kind of where the idea for the course sparked. I wanted my students to understand this sort of dual and dueling process of racial progress and racist response. The phrase white rage, I'm actually borrowing from a historian named Kel Anderson. She's a professor at Emory University, and she's written a book on the subject matter where she traces this process of racial progress and the response to Black advancement in any form, and she roots it following the Civil War. Now, the class itself takes a step back and actually traces how racist ideas came into existence. So my students learn that racism is not the product of ignorance or hatred, but in fact, it is economic interest, it is social investment that motivated the justification for enslavement. And in that process, European travelers created a narrative that they then fed their superiors in Europe. So creating ideas about others, non-white others in particular. And so my students learn the birthplace and are introduced to the architects of racist ideas, and they're learning how these ideas evolved over time, and that there were different theories that these architects, and I should say these are intellectuals, these are theologians, these are lawyers, these are top elites, educated individuals who developed these various theories.
And we're going back generations, we're going back centuries at this point.
We are. And it's important because the American founding fathers, my students learned a little bit more about Cotton Mather. So they learned how the colonial legislators and theologians who first arrived in the United States, in fact, drew these theories and developed theories of their own. Cotton Mather was, as Ibram Kendi calls him, one of the first assimilationists who used conversion theory to show, on the one hand, solidify the docility and the inferiority of enslaved people, but at the same time, used Christianity to introduce uplift and elevate Christianity in that process. So the students learn different theories. They learn who these architects are and have been throughout, and see how that evolves over time in the course of history. And I think a number of my students, the class was pretty full, but it filled up after January 6th. And I think many of the students probably thought that this course would exclusively address that kind of history. And it's true that the course does consider racial violence and how that manifests in its various forms, medical racism. We're looking at residential segregation. We're looking at educational inequality. We look at political suppression, voter suppression in particular. We look at how the law functions in this context. So the students learn how violence can take on different forms. And I've explained that to them. But we also, of course, I hope that the students understand better and are better able to contextualize what has happened in recent times, and not just on January 6th, but in the last 4 years, the kind of rhetoric that we've seen in public discourses and, of course, also political action and how that, where does that come from? What is it a response to? So these are some of the themes that the students are engaging with. And I've been struck, the students have been extraordinary so far. They've been really curious. They're really eager. They're thirsty to understand some of these longer historical trajectories. They are interested in understanding how politics works and who are the people who create these ideas, who are the ones who sustain those ideologies within the political realm, within the legislative realm, but also to understand that they're producers and then they're consumers of racism. And this is where I introduce, that happens kind of a little bit later in the semester, when I also introduce them to the idea of white fragility. So it's really a class that stands on three different thematic pillars. There is the origins of racist ideology, then there is white rage as a response and its various manifestations, and there's also white fragility, the defensiveness or the very minimalistic understanding of what racism can look like. And I think most students might think that it is this sort of open violence. It's the people wearing white hoods and organized in secrecy. And so what they learn, in fact, that racism is something that everybody partakes, especially as a white person, and that by definition, they have work to do and to unlearn. In fact, now they know how long those ideas go back, that they understand the challenges of unlearning these ideas.
How difficult has it been to create this course, to adapt this course, as events have kept happening, which hit on these themes over and over again?
I appreciate that you asked this question, quite frankly, and I think I can echo some of my colleagues. My department has actually adopted a theme of racial injustice and inequality and the struggle for racial equality. And this course is one element in the broader curriculum. And I know that I was texting and speaking with colleagues as we were developing these new courses on these subject matters. And all of us were editing and revising, reading, shifting topics, thinking about how can we further our students' understanding of these historical issues. I don't think it's ever taken me this long to build a course. I mean, obviously, I've been sitting on this topic for a while, knowing that usually we decide on a curriculum early fall. So I've known for a while that I'd be teaching this class, and it does percolate for quite some time. But it took me every day for a couple of weeks. And certainly after January 6th, I've had to make some decisions and added some reading as primers. But more than anything, it allowed me to really refine the way I wanted to present this course to the students. It really, in fact, gave me confidence that what I was doing was necessary. It was really critical. The day before, Raphael Warnock was elected as the first, Georgia's first senator. And the following day,
African-American senator.
And the following day, we see the siege on the Capitol unraveling in front of American eyes. And I think this idea of Black advancement and white rage couldn't have been more explicit in my view in that moment. And so in many ways, it really highlighted just how critical this course was to me in this moment, and I think to the students as well. So far, the students have been extraordinarily curious, very articulate, very sensitive. I did assign a lot more reading than I would normally assign, and I told them to bear with me, and I did tell them that I made these decisions rather unapologetically. And so far, they've done really, really well. We'll see how they feel about this my decisions in week 12. But yeah, I'm really kind of taking them on a journey to understand some of these issues. But if I had to sort of really distill, like if I had to really digest in a short way of what I want them to get away, is that there's a collective responsibility to engage with these issues, and that white rage is not something that's always the visible violence. It works its way through bureaucracies. Legislations are involved in that process. And I want them to understand that politically, it's really critical to understand how the law is made and that there's a color to law.
And if people want to keep up on the latest from the history department at UTC, they can go to utc.edu/history or follow on Twitter at UTCHistory.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. This weekend, here on WUTC, Ensemble Theater of Chattanooga presents the radio drama Grenadine from the play by Neil Wexler. You'll hear it this Saturday at 7 p.m. on ETC's Digital Theater Showcase, a new monthly program on our own Moondog Matinee. I spoke with Neil Wexler, who is a playwright, a filmmaker, and a mixed media artist based in Buffalo, New York. Neil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
How did you become a playwright?
That's a very good question. And a very hard one to answer, actually. I had done a few plays in college and high school, but not really as a full-time thing. I was a runner. That was my extracurricular. So like once that was in high school and college, but I dabbled a little bit. So it was after school, I was doing some writing, some academic writing, actually, and thinking I was going to go to grad school. But as I was working on that academic writing, I decided I wanted to go more into just my own sort of work. So I started doing that on the side. And this actually connects to writing and Grenadine, so it can answer two questions in one. I was working on a novel. Grenadine was a novel originally. As I was working on it, and I showed it to a friend. The friend read it. And at page 20, my printer had printed out a blank page at around 20. And as he was reading it, he raised the blank page to me and said, you know, this is the best page so far. And that was like, oh, man, well, that's just great. That's thank you. I've been working on this. There are 240 more pages, by the way, that aren't blank. But he was actually right. There were serious problems with it as a novel. And so I remember I was seeing a play in Buffalo, Juno and the Paycock, and this actor, Jerry Marr, was playing Joxer in it. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is Grenadine. Like I got it, not that play particularly, but like that novel has to become a play. Right. And so I just started just cutting away all the fat, all the getting characters from place to place. And it just became about the dialogue. And interestingly, that actor wound up playing the lead character in a production of the play. So just all this sort of weird connections to it. So I turned it into a play. My wife actually said, you know, you should submit it to this contest, the Yale Drama Prize. Edward Albee is the judge. And it's like, you know, and I'm like, oh, come on. It's not going to not gonna win this prize. But she convinced me and I submitted it and won that prize. And I know that I was sort of answering a bunch of different questions, but that kind of combines a lot of the elements of both like my trajectory to becoming a playwright and then the evolving of this play itself.
Not only are you a playwright, but you're also a filmmaker and a mixed media artist.
Playwriting, as most playwrights will tell you, is tough to kind of just do playwriting. And so over time, I've just become involved in a lot of different things, which is so true of many theater artists. You wind up taking on a lot of different types of gigs. You work with schools, you work in all these different capacities, which you grow to love. So some of those different things were, I ran an educational playwriting company for a while, Against the Grain Theater Festival in Buffalo. We had an international student playwriting competition. So I got to work with a lot of students with that. I work a lot as a dramaturg, as the filmmaking. One of the projects I worked on was at the University of Waterloo with a cinematographer and filmmaker there, Glenn Stiller. And it was this film that I originally wrote it as a play, this play called Orphans of Elsinore. So again, another one of these things which started out as one thing and then, oh, maybe it can work as this film. And he's like, oh, this would be a great project for a media studies. So it wound up connecting all these different areas. And to me, that's a lot of what, for me as a theater artist, what it's all about. Like, what is a film? What is a play? What is education? What is the, you know, what are all these different kind of components that connect to the work? And I think the last year and a half has really, well, year, it feels like, but it's really changed how we think about all of these different elements and how they can interrelate. And so as tough a time as it's been, in a way, it's embodied a lot of what I think a lot of theater artists do anyway, which is kind of connect to a lot of different occupations and different genres. And so as tough as this last year has been, it's in a way, I think the silver lining for a lot of theater artists has been that it's kind of showed how a lot of these things do connect and certain paths forward.
And where the elements have not changed because of the past year, how we see them has changed.
Absolutely. And thinking through how we see them. And it's been tough. I mean, there's no doubt that like the Zoom world of creating theater has been, I just was at the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival, actually directing a virtual production of Grenadine. So this was going to be, obviously, the Kennedy Center, there are different regions, and it was going to be, you know, in person, and all the students and they come together, but now it was through Zoom. And directing actors in this medium, it's like, okay, you have a wall, and like, here are your blocking notes, and it's like 6 feet of space, and like basically where I am right now, this is how I directed them and how it all got blocked. It's super challenging. The actors, theater actors, are used to working with one another. All of a sudden they're sort of in film, right? But it's not quite film. It doesn't have all the it's not like a big old production studio. So it's challenging in the sense that it does the sort of, let's call it the production value of lighting and sound, all that stuff that, let's face it, that's what makes a lot of stuff look good. When you look at a great show on TV, a lot of what you're really buying into, of course, is just how well that production value, right? So it's tough when you're working with students to be like, but we're working on all of the really cool core elements. From a process standpoint, I think we've been learning so much. And if we can kind of get past the like, yeah, it's not going to look great. It's not going to sound great. It's not going to, because all these things, but there will be moments and there will be ways of thinking through these things that are going to help you evolve as an artist and as a person. And like the teaching piece of it, I think is so crucial because you're learning that sort of media literacy. I mean, so much comes down to like sight and sound and just all the elements.
It's a journey, just as Grenadine itself is a journey.
Yeah, it's a great segue, actually. And it's been interesting how that piece of it has played into a lot of this, which is how we think about a story. What is a story, right? What is a story? And I think too often we focus on end states, which is like, where does it go? Like, what's the log line? All those things. And we know we need that for certain reasons. But from a creative standpoint and from the true standpoint of like understanding how a story affects us as human beings, it's about the process, right? And like, I think one thing that this year has done and like that theater always does that doesn't get foregrounded enough is like tie us into process and all the work that goes into figuring out like who this character is, what this path is. And as you say, with like Grenadine, and that's, it's a play about discovering oneself, discovering those around you.
To share with folks what we're talking about here, the synopsis for Grenadine, a man searches for love in the company of his three devoted friends. The bonds of friendship are challenged and ultimately reaffirmed by the quartet's journey through an unfamiliar landscape. The play is about longing and perseverance.
Yeah. If I would throw in one other word, you know, it's funny you say long, it's like longing, frustration, and perseverance. And I think like, you know, it's funny when you just like, one of the hardest things for me anyway, and probably for, I'm sure for a lot of playwrights, is that whole summary piece of it. Right? It's like, because that's the place where we get away from process. And you're like, no, it's about, Edward Albee once said this really funny thing to me when I was struggling with like coming up with a summary, because, you know, I got to meet him through the Yale Drama Prize. And it was just this great thing. And I was like, it's always tough, like saying, you know, what's your play about? And he's like, oh, you just say, what's your play about? It's about 90 minutes. I'm like, well, it actually, Grenadine's about 60 minutes, just so you know, it's a 60 minute play, because I know it's a 1 hour airing time. But anyway, you just give the length of the, you give the time. And I was like, I don't think that's going to work for most companies, Edward. Maybe if Edward Albee's name is attached, you can say my play is about 60 minutes. But for the rest of us, that might be a little trickier. But the point is, like in that summary you just read, so there is this sense of, it's a simple story, a man searching for the woman he loves. Okay, but man, we need a little more, right? There are complications, right? The woman's rejected him. So he and his three friends have spent 3 years on a prison farm because they stole an engagement ring for Grenadine, and which he promptly threw back at him. And the main character's name is Prismatic. And so on leaving the prison farm, when he tells his friends, hey, so we're going to go back for her. They're like, wait a minute, we just spent 3 years on the, and it sets off this journey. So we have his longing, and then it sets off this journey where they pretty much fail at everything. They can't find food. They can't get along. They can't even find the right road that they think they need to find her. They're constantly failing at everything they do, but they keep persevering. And the big question that the play raises is, how do we learn to persevere? Because for me, those three elements, like longing, frustration, and perseverance, that's life. I mean, that's my, and that's why I wrote the play. That's what gets me, is like, how do you, we want certain things. We have these big dreams, and those dreams get squashed. and that's just basically on a daily level. And it's not like, we sometimes think in terms of the big picture, but like it's the minutia, it's the little things that are constantly, we try one little thing, it gets thrown back in our face, but we have to keep moving forward. So it's that process. And again, as you mentioned, like it does connect to everything we've done this last year, because it's trying to focus on these little achievements while we continually face adversity, and how do we push past that? And that's not easy to push past it. So that's why the question drives the play, and it drives me.
And what are you working on now? What's next for you?
Another sort of mixed media kind of project, actually just a few different projects, but the one I've been working on last couple of weeks. So I'll talk about that one. It's a video piece for a site-specific production in Texas. And it's a new company called Going Dark Theatrics. And they're doing an adaptation. It's a reworking or rethinking of Dante's Inferno. I'm doing a piece on one of the sections of it. So it involves video, it involves editing, it involves, again, sort of bringing together all these different pieces. They're currently looking for a site. They're dealing with all the issues that so many companies are looking for in terms of what are the regulations. So talk about a work in process that's dealing with all these types of things. It's like a lot of the projects that I'm winding up working on, it's like you're bringing in, all of a sudden we're making videos, and all of a sudden we're editing, and we're, well, does that make it a film? Does that make it a play? So it's so interesting, I think, that all the projects that I've been involved with, I know that a lot of companies are, it's trying to figure out what is theater, but then also trying not to limit it, but then not making it so broad that like, oh, well, everything is theater. And then you run into those problems. But again, I think if we can focus on the questions and what we're learning about it, and so all these projects, they bring together, again, like where we are as humans right now. So it's an exciting time at the same time that it's super just challenging for everyone.
And where can people go online to keep up on all that you do?
So I have a website, Wechsler Projects. So it's spelling of my last name is a little confusing. So WECHSLERprojects.com. And I'm on Instagram with the same name. So yeah, that's basically where I post stuff that I'm doing.
All right. Neil, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listen to Grenadine this Saturday at 7 p.m. on ETC's Digital Theater Showcase, part of Moondog Matinee, here on WUTC. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. We will have new shows from Barking Legs in a couple of weeks. Their first show this year is scheduled for tomorrow evening. It's a free show streaming on their website with Sean Perkinson playing guitar and John Steele playing bass. This afternoon we have another show from the Isis Theatre in Asheville, this one featuring Peggy Ratus. Peggy and her partner Aaron Price's Bygone Blues project was born from a shared passion for vintage blues, particularly the women singers, who were much more successful than the men in the 1920s and 1930s. Recorded in front of a socially distanced audience in the Isis Theatre in Asheville, their show on Friday, January 29th, honoured, among others, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, Marlene Johnson, Lil Johnson, Mamie Smith, along with original compositions from the band. The band is Aaron Price playing piano, Justin Ray playing the trumpet, and Zach Page on bass.
I want to welcome everybody that's in the house tonight, and I want to welcome the folks that are listening from the comfort of their living rooms. It's my great honor to have been able to put together such a stellar instrumentalist band to help me celebrate the music that was recorded by a few of the Black Pearls and blues and jazz divas from the 1920s and the 1930s. Many of the songs we'll play tonight have been recorded by a plethora of female blues and jazz singers, from the originals Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, Ella Fitzgerald, Catherine Russell, Nikki Yanofsky, just to name a few.
Soon every morning, I'm staggering up and down that street. If I can't get no whiskey, give me some gin or good wine. The way I'm feeling, I wanna stay drunk all the time. I drink so much whiskey. Well, soon in morning, I'm staggering up and down the street. When I can't get no whiskey, that's when everything goes all wrong. Every morning I'm staggering up and down the street.
Can't help it. Gonna drink until the end.
we know that too well. All right, so Ma Rainey, born Gertrude Pridgett, April 26, 1886, was one of the earliest known American professional blues singers and one of the first generation of such singers to record. She was billed as the mother of the blues, as we all know. I'm sure many of you watched the movie Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, so you have a sense of the powerful singer, straight-ahead, no-nonsense person she is known to be. She was known to be. This one she wrote around 1927. She recorded it with Georgia Tom Dorsey on piano and Tampa Red on guitar. It's a true story. It's called Black Eyed Blues.
He's the sugar in my tea, jelly in my rum. Well, he got me going, but I don't know where I'm headed for. I can't sleep a doggone wink unless he's by my side. My mind's so messed up, I can't think without my easy ride. He got me going. He got me going, but I don't know where I'm headed for.
Got me going. It's a cute song. It's a little bit cuter than the last one. So Madeline Peyrou covered this song. Lil Johnson was another bawdy blues singer and writer. She's another fine artist that historians are hard-pressed to find anything substantial about her beginnings. It's not known where she was born or where she died. The recordings are about all they have to go on, and those started around 1929. Here's one they found called Was I? We got Aaron on guitar again. Yeah.
thought I'd step out one night. I longed to get the thrilling life I missed. I met a youth, a bit uncouth, although he seemed alright. I knew him by the moment when we kissed. Then I got home next day with swollen head. My girlfriend asked if I had fun, I said. Was I drunk? Was he handsome? And did mama give me hell? Did I get a thrill and am I full of quiver? Was he rough? Did I care? Almost shame to say, every time I think of him, do I shiver? Was he hot? And was I? And he, would he stand for maybe? He would not. Did I lie? Does he still think I'm a baby? If I was, am I still? Oh, I don't care at all. Was he drunk? Was he handsome? And did mama give me hell?
Thank you so much. So, I got a little story about this next song. The very first recording of any blues singer, male or female, was done Valentine's in 1920. Mamie Smith and her Jazz Hounds recorded two songs. One of them was released, and it started this whole revolution of people of color in all these communities all across the United States, purchasing phonographs so they could buy this record and hear this song. So Aaron and I and a bunch of other people, we did a show a few years ago. We actually did it here at ISIS called Women in Blues History. So when I was looking up the history and found this song and all the particulars around it, you know, I told my husband. And he and Aaron go to the National Record Day every year at Harvest Records. He found a copy of Crazy Blues, the very first blues record recorded by a vocalist. And here it is.
I can't sleep at night. I can't eat a bite. 'Cause the man I love, he don't treat me right. So blue, I don't know what to do. Sometimes I sit and sigh and then begin to cry. He went away, he never said goodbye. Well, I can read his letters, but I sure can't read his mind. Thought he was loving me, he's leaving all the time. Blind. a baby. Oh, and I snatched it back. My baby's gone, and he gave me the sack. Now I got the crazy blues since my baby went away.
It's a good one. Thank you so much. Okay, so this one is a song that kind of speaks for itself. It's one of the most recorded songs in history. And W.C. Handy takes credit for writing it. It's called St. Louis Blues.
My man has a heart like a rock cast in the sea.
Thank you. St. Louis Blues. All right. We've come to our last song. So Bessie Smith and her with the Bessemer Singers and James P. Johnson on piano recorded this in 1930. It's written by Andy Razaf. Have you ever seen a church begin to rock? Heard a sundown deacon preaching to his flock? Have you ever seen old Satan on the run? Sermon stir your soul, make you crave the River Jordan as you go. Have you ever felt as though you'd like to shout? Then come on now and let them feelings out. Oh Lordy, just hear those sisters groaning and hear those brothers moaning, repenting and atoning on revival day. They talk into the spirit, just like you see and hear it. They sinful and they fear it on revival day. When that congregation starts to sing, nothing in this world can mean a thing. Oh, glory, hallelujah, make you feel so peculiar. The devil cannot fool you on revival day. Thank you. thank you all so, so much. Thank you for contributing to our tip jar. Philip, our tip jar. Thank you, Isis. Thank you for the staff. Thank you, Mark, on sound. We really appreciate it. Please be safe going home. Love you guys.
Peggy Ratus, along with Aaron Price playing piano, Justin Ray playing trumpet, and Zach Page on bass in the Isis Theatre in Asheville a couple of weeks back on January 30th. Their show is called The Bygone Blues Project. This is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.